Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you so much for braving the weather. And I will get started. And we might as well start with that. It's never easy to judge such things, but I suspect Federigo Barocci is the most unfamiliar of all the heroes of this lecture series. He was unquestionably the last with whom I got to grips, thus missing the vast and extraordinary exhibition devoted to him, which Andrea Emiliani organized in Bologna in 1975, when I was an undergraduate and could have gone. And yet he is quite possibly the one who now gives me the most sheer pleasure. He lived a long and patiently industrious life. He was born around 1533 or 35 and died in 1612. And he executed a considerable number of substantial paintings, almost all of which are religious in subject matter. Even more crucially in the present context, he was also without question the most prolific draftsman of the entire Italian Renaissance, and a vast number of his drawings have survived, above all in two huge concentrations, respectively in Berlin and the Uffizi. In fact, a major consequence of the sheer scale of his drawn oeuvre is that there does not yet exist a complete catalogue of his drawings, although many are published and illustrated in the two editions of Andrea Emiliani's fundamental monograph on his work. In consequence, a number of the sheets I will be showing this afternoon are virtually unknown, and I therefore crave your forgiveness if a few of the images of them are abysmal. Barocci virtually never stirred from his native Urbino after a brief youthful sojourn in Rome, which he fled, convinced that jealous rivals had invited him to a meal and poisoned his salad. It is tempting to assume that he was in fact suffering from some sort of digestive disorder, such as an ulcer or irritable bowel syndrome. But in any event, the consequence was that he refused to travel and that work had to come to him. His success at home and the wide diffusion of his paintings are both reflections of the extraordinary esteem in which he was held. Barocci's Garbo-like reclusiveness proves to have been a godsend when it comes to reconstructing the evolution of the commission for the Madonna del Popolo, the Madonna of the People, which is signed and dated 1579, because every stage of the process was perforce chronicled in written form, and by good fortune these records have been preserved. The epistolary ping-pong amounts to almost 30 letters. The work in question was executed for the altar of the chapel of the Fraternità dei Laici, also called the Fraternità della Misericordia, in the medieval church of Santa Maria della Pieve at Arezzo. This altar had been constructed for the Brotherhood in 1572 by no less a figure than Giorgio Vasari, who had been born in Arezzo, lived there during his last years, and was a member of the confraternity to boot. And that same year, they had entrusted him with the task of executing their altarpiece to fill the altar frame, and had offered him 200 scudi to do so. But his death on the 27th of June 1574 meant they had to look further afield. Less than a month after Vasari's demise, they wrote to Nofri Rosselli, the Comune of Arezzo's ambassador at the court of Cosimo I de' Medici in Florence, to ask his advice about a possible replacement. By the 30th of October 1574, the rectors of the Pia Confraternita had addressed their first letter to Rosselli's recommendation, Barocci, concerning the possibility of his executing their altarpiece. The intriguing fact that Rosselli chose Barocci as opposed to a Florentine painter in Vasari's image has not generally been commented upon, but there is some evidence of context between Barocci and Florence, and moreover, he had clearly already acquired a certain reputation by this date. In 1568, Vasari himself had described him as a giovane di grande aspettazione, which in Dickensian mode may be translated as a youth with great expectations. In that initial communication from the confraternita, the subject of the altarpiece is already specified. They refer to il mistero della misericordia, the mystery of misericordia, the subject now known as the Madonna della Misericordia, in which, as most memorably in the example you're seeing by Piero della Francesca, the Virgin is represented sheltering the faithful under her outstretched mantle. Baroci was clearly impressed by the desirability of winning the contract and in effect replied by return on the 5th of November. His letter is amusingly torn between his desire to accommodate his potential patrons and his determination to make it abundantly plain from the outset that he does not want to paint the Madonna della Misericordia. He suggests that whereas the Madonna della Misericordia is not a soggetto troppo a proposito per fare una bella tavola, not a subject that's appropriate to make a beautiful painting, there are numerous other mysteries or histories, the terms seem to be being employed interchangeably here, of the Virgin, which would fit the bill and specifies the Annunciation, the Visitation, and the Assumption. There remains the question of why Baroci was so averse to the prospect of painting a representation of the Madonna della Misericordia, which would have been the natural preference of a confraternity dedicated to that devotion. The most plausible reason is that he had just executed an altarpiece on a closely related theme, or was even still in the process of so doing. In this Immaculate Conception, which you see on the right, now in the Galleria Nazionale delle Marche in Urbino, Baroci depicts the Virgin standing on a crescent moon with her arms outstretched and her mantle billowing out to her left, flanked in the manner of a Madonna della Misericordia by the faithful to either side below. These donors are shown bust length in order to achieve a suitable effect of subordination while at the same time eschewing the archaic convention of representing such supporting players on a diminutive scale in the way Piero did. Unsurprisingly, this novel conception was not arrived at immediately. A pen and wash drawing over black chalk on grey-blue paper heightened with white by Baroci in the Louvre, which I'm showing you, represents a somewhat different first idea for the altarpiece. I should add that the framing elements you see, which are not reproduced in any of the Baroci literature, are original and were drawn by him. In spite of the fact that it conspicuously lacks a single attribute or symbol customarily connected with the Immaculate Conception, which was the confraternity's devotion, a sheet in the Uffizi has routinely been linked with the Urbino altarpiece. And this is the sheet I'm showing you on the right. However, recently Stuart Lingo has made the brilliant suggestion that this Uffizi drawing may instead be a first idea for the Arezzo altarpiece for the Madonna del Popolo. This seems all but proven by a crucial difference between the two commissions he overlooked. Whereas the Immaculate Conception and the studies for it are lit from the left, the Madonna del Popolo and the Uffizi drawing are lit from the right. In any event, it is hardly surprising if Baroci was loath to repeat much the same compositional idea in what was all but his next major commission, although the Uffizi drawing appears to demonstrate that he was briefly willing to explore that possibility. After the initial contact, there follows an exchange of letters from the 12th of November 1574 to the 19th of May 15, 1975, in which the rectors of the confraternity try to cajole Baracci into coming to Arezzo to view the altarpiece's destination, both to see the lighting of the space firsthand and to discuss the details of the work's subject matter. And Baracci pleads ill health. He cannot ride a horse for even 2 miles, he explains, and proposes that they should send him a rough ground plan of the chapel, principally indicating where the light comes from, whether it comes from the left or the right, something he evidently knew when he executed, let's go back, executed that Uffizi drawing. Even sending Maestro Bastiano Scarpellino, who is referred to in other documents, including the contract, as Sebastiano di Giovanni, Scultore Aretino, an Aretine sculptor, to Urbino as an emissary, fails to dislodge their quarry. Finally, on the 18th of June, 1575, and in the presence of the artist, the contract for the altarpiece is drawn up. It outlines the broad requirements concerning subject matter, specifying that the historia, the history, which is arguably hardly the most just, should represent the Most Glorious Virgin Mary interceding and praying to her Son Jesus Christ for the people, popolo, and further that the said people should be portrayed in their various appropriate characters. No details are given concerning the representation of the people, but it seems reasonable to suppose, as will be discussed more fully in due course, that Baracci had already provided the confraternity with some sort of relatively finished drawing of the overall composition, which would have made plain the iconographical originality of his scheme, which will be addressed at the end of this lecture, when I will also explain both its hitherto unrecognized true subject matter and its precedence. To return to the contract, there then follows, not quite as an afterthought, a stipulation that Baracci must, in addition, paint a small tondo corresponding to a similar roundel carved in stone in the pediment of the chapel's pre-existing altar, whose figure or figures shall be at his discretion. The vagueness of this final requirement is surprising, since, as will eventually become apparent, the inclusion of God the Father, which is what was actually painted, somewhere within the composition was all but obligatory in a Madonna del Popolo. The tondo in question, which is far from perfectly preserved, remained in Arezzo when the main panel made its way to Florence, and it's hidden away in the ownership of the confraternity, and you're seeing it here in a very murky photo. The remaining clauses of the contract are concerned with various practical matters. Predictably enough, since Baracci was a card-carrying perfectionist, the altarpiece was not completed on time, and over the next 4 years there are a number of letters which chronicle the artist's threadbare excuses and his patron's mounting frustration. A note of the 31st of March 1579 in the confraternity's papers alludes to the idea of sending Baracci a letter of congratulation on his having completed the altarpiece, and is followed on the 1st of May by the decision to send one Michelangelo Barbani to Urbino to organise the work's safe transportation to Arezzo. This was no easy matter, but it would appear that Baracci took exaggerated precautions, and the confraternity's final communication with the artist, which dates from the 30th of June of that year, includes complaints not only about the expenses incurred, but also about the absurdity of the altarpieces having been armata come una macchina da guerra, armor-plated like a war machine. At this point, the picture had been installed, and the long-suffering Aretines evidently felt able to let off steam. Indeed, they contrived to direct their bile both at the fact that the paint began to lift after a mere 10 days, and at what they deemed the artistic weakness of the work. The painting here doesn't attain that good quality which we were expecting, is what they say. The extraordinary quality of the altarpiece will be discussed briefly later on, And what makes the petulance and ingratitude of the rectors hard to forgive? And it makes their behaviour hard to forgive. But what even they could not have denied is that Barocci took an arguably unprecedented amount of trouble over the design and preparation of their painting, according to his own estimation, twice what he agreed to. It is not hard to demonstrate that a very considerable number of drawings for the work must have perished over time, but even so, I'm counting rectos and versos separately, there are nearly 100 sheets which survive, more than for any other commission undertaken by the artist. However, before examining at least a selection of these drawings, it seems important to illustrate two distinct categories of preparatory studies Barocci routinely executed for major paintings, and may well have made for the Madonna del Popolo, for all that none survives. The first category are grisaille oil sketches on paper, and in this case, inevitably, I am showing you on the left the ravishing example for Barocci's altarpiece for Senigallia of 1589-93, representing the Madonna of the Rosary, which is just down the road in the Ashmolean. The second category involves detailed head studies, such as this one for the figure of Mary Magdalene in his entombment of 1579-82 for Santa Croce, again in Senigallia. And this is in oil on paper laid down on canvas, and it's now in Bayonne. It used to be believed that Barocci also made coloured oil bozzetti or sketches for whole compositions, but it is now generally agreed that all such pieces, including this one, which is connected with the Senigallia entombment again, are actually later copies by other hands, or just conceivably autograph repetitions, but that they played no part in the process of preparation. Turning to the drawings, the most important of these by far is the large-scale and richly layered modello for the composition as a whole, formerly at Chatsworth and now in the collection of Anne Bent in Chicago, the work you see on the left, whose departure from these shores I am inclined to regard as just about the biggest national heritage disaster in the field of old master drawing since the Second World War. In spite of the fact that their general appearance is broadly similar, it differs significantly from the finished altarpiece in a number of ways. Starting at the top, it is notable that while the central group of the Blessing Christ flanked by an adolescent angel, admittedly without a pipe and with two additional companions in the painting, and the supplicatory Virgin is essentially unchanged, two flying putti holding sprays of roses have been added to the upper corners in the painting, as have two further putti below the Virgin, and there are additional angelic presences just discernible in the golden radiance backing Christ. Moreover, in the altarpiece, the Dove of the Holy Spirit is rigidly frontal, as opposed to diagonally disposed. Conversely, the four diminutive seraph or cherub heads at Christ's feet have been reduced to three. Most significantly of all, a child angel below the Virgin, apparently holding a ring in his right hand and an inscribed sheet of paper in his left, is excised from the altarpiece. Proceeding to the terrestrial sphere and moving from left to right, it is apparent that the left half of the composition is all but unchanged, apart from the replacement of the figure kissing the ground by two prominent donors in the middle ground, and some alterations to children around the kneeling mother in the bottom left-hand corner. In the drawing, there is a child at the left edge of the composition seen from behind, who disappears. The foreground boy is naked, not clothed, and his older sister beyond is shown kneeling, but her hands are not yet joined in prayer. In contrast, the action in the right foreground has been radically modified. In the drawing, a bearded man, evidently a member of the confraternity, is shown bending forward and giving alms to a half-naked beggar seen from the rear, whose uncomfortable pose must be intended to indicate the fact that he is crippled. Further over, a hurdy-gurdy player, accompanied by a yapping dog, looks heavenwards and winds his instrument. In the painting, however, the bearded benefactor is replaced by a woman, whose costume suggests she is meant to be a gypsy, holding her baby and a wicker basket. And it is she who is being tipped a coin by a child, while a member of the confraternity at the extreme margin of the image looks down and contemplates this act of, conceivably in his eyes, misplaced kindness. The hurdy-gurdy player's head is lowered and his blindness is made explicit. His dog, now clearly a spaniel, has calmed down. And last but not least, the beggar, who has survived relatively unmodified in the altarpiece, still stretches out his hand for a coin, but it is not clear whether he too will be rewarded. Study of the remaining preparatory drawings for Madonna del Popolo reveals that Barocci executed a considerable number of more detailed studies of individual figures and groups that relate to the Chicago sheet as opposed to the finished altarpiece. There are two possible explanations for this. One is that he decided to work out the precise appearance of all the elements of the compositional study before actually executing it, while the other is that he made these drawings after the compositional study on the assumption that the altarpiece would in essence correspond to it, and only subsequently felt the need to improve on what he had hoped was going to be his final solution. It is virtually impossible to prove which of these scenarios reflects what actually happened. But, as we have already seen in previous weeks, there are certainly instances of other artists changing their minds after seemingly having worked out exactly what they wanted to represent. Indeed, Barocci himself is an artist who may be added to their number. In this instance, the changes were so numerous that it seems only reasonable to presume that Barocci must have needed to create a second Modello. For all that it has never been reproduced in the Barocci literature, what appears to be a substantial fragment of a detailed study for precisely such a Modello has survived in Berlin. And it's what you're seeing. Clearly a part of a once larger whole, which must have been about half the size of the bent drawing, it is executed in brown pen and wash with white heightening on squared beige paper and includes much of the bottom right corner of the design. The head of the beggar just squeezes into its bottom left corner, and then the hurdy-gurdy player, the woman with her child, the boy giving her arms, the fugue of confraternity members, and a decapitated flying putto are all present. When the attitudes of these various actors are compared with those of their counterparts in the finished work, the differences are minor, but more than sufficient to lay to rest any doubts about the preliminary nature of this sheet. The most notable modifications concern the angle of the musician's head and his instrument, and the fact that the putto is seen from the front rather than the rear. It nevertheless remains the case that it is far less finished than the Chicago sheet, as well as being on a smaller scale. In looking at the remaining drawings, I will start at the top and move down. There are about 20 drawings for the celestial zone, of which the most significant by far is the only substantial fragment of the original cartoon, which is in the middle here, which was first published as long ago as 1981, but had tended to be overlooked in the scholarly literature on Barocci until it was the subject of a recent article by Carmen Bambach in the Burlington Magazine in 2015. Squared for transfer and executed in the medium of black chalk, as was traditional for cartoons, it comprises the upper left corner of the composition, down to the tips of the adolescent angel's toes, and including most, but not quite all, of the figure of Christ. In originally publishing it, Pierre Rosenberg contended that it was closer to the Chicago sheet than to the finished altarpiece, while Carmen Bambach thought it preceded that Chicago sheet. But in truth, it seems to chronicle an intriguing and somewhat unexpected transitional phase between the two. Thus, the angel still retains his pipe, as in the drawing, but the more frontal angle of his head and the definition of his right wing look forward to the painting. In the same vein, the top corner is now filled by a putto bearing rose branches, but he is accompanied by at least one subsidiary companion who was excised before the altarpiece was actually painted. Turning to Christ, who is rather unexpectedly represented without a beard, both the disposition of his drapery and the way the fourth and little fingers of his right hand are folded down correspond to the drawing as opposed to the painting. In fact, both options for the hand are studied simultaneously in a sheet in Berlin, which you're seeing here, a red and black chalk drawing on blue paper heightened with white. And, as might be expected, the one found in the painting is a second thought. No less intriguing is the fact that the precise location of the putto in the corner has been adjusted, which is surprising in the context of what might be assumed to be the artist's final thoughts before actually starting to paint. The explanation of all these oddities must be that the alterations the artist subsequently made to the cartoon were fundamentally insignificant, with the result that Barocci did not see any necessity to start all over again. Remaining studies for the upper zone include a number connected with the four flying putti who were added to the scheme after the bent drawing, such as this pair of drawings connected with the top left corner, which are both in the Uffizi. The lower one is particularly revealing of Barocci's reluctance to waste good ideas, since the putto with his hands joined in prayer, who does not feature in the Madonna del Popolo, takes a bow in the artist's later Virgin and Child with Saints Anthony, Abbot and Lucy in the Louvre. Further studies relate to the corresponding putto on the other side, and indeed to the first conception of the angel, who is studied from the life in the nude and the Virgin. When it comes to the chubby... So there's the angel in the nude, and there's the Virgin. When it comes to the chubby putto below the Virgin seen from behind, the most important drawing is the cartoon fragment in the Biblioteca Ambrosiana in Milan, which faithfully corresponds to the figure as executed but omits his wings. So too do sheets in the Uffizi and Berlin, and a study, and the study I'm now talking about is the one on the left, and a study which is one of over 30 drawings by Barocci in Dessau in the former East Germany, which all belong to an 18th century German artist called Friedrich Wilhelm von Erdmannsdorff and were exhibited as being by him before being correctly identified as the work of Barocci in 1993 by Werner Schader. They still remain all but unpublished and unknown, although eight were properly exhibited and reproduced in the catalogue of an exhibition shown in Rome and Dessau in 2014-15. But unfortunately, none of the ones that were shown were the ones for the Madonna del Popolo, which is why the reproductions you'll see, including this one, are so ghastly. In addition to the studies for the various figures in the upper zone, there is also a substantial sheet in Urbino to scale in red and black chalk on pale beige paper, you're seeing it on the right, which corresponds to the dramatically foreshortened Dove of the Holy Spirit as it appears in the painting. To this may be added what I believe to be another study for the Dove on the left, also to scale in charcoal on grey-brown prepared paper in the British Museum, hitherto associated with the Carracci and Giacomo Cavedone, but which probably represents a fractionally earlier stage in the artist's thinking. Moving on to the lower zone of the composition, it is probably simplest to discuss the various preparatory drawings in groups, proceeding from left to right, and from the foreground to the background. Barocci, like his great exemplar Correggio, and for all that he never married, was fascinated and enchanted by the exuberance and joie de vivre of children, as is apparent in a considerable number of his works. Nevertheless, the left foreground of the Madonna del Popolo is a particularly fine example of this affectionate concern. It is dominated by a group consisting of an elegantly dressed young mother with two children. She has seen the celestial apparition and seeks to point it out to her smiling young son, who is kneeling with his hands joined in prayer, but he is distracted by the activity over on the other side of the space, and judging by the direction of his gaze, has been led astray by the music of the hurdy-gurdy. In the bent drawing, by contrast, where he is naked, his expression is one of surprise bordering on apprehension, presumably at the barking dog. A considerable number of sheets, including some of the most spectacular associated with the altarpiece, are devoted to these various figures, and they almost all appear to be connected with the final evolution of the composition as opposed to the Chicago drawing. An exception is a sheet of studies for the kneeling boy, in which a second child seen from behind who disappears in the altarpiece as executed is still included. Two of the remainder are in pen and wash. This one in Budapest, which also features an unrelated figure of Christ, probably for Barocci's Perdono di Assisi altarpiece in Urbino, and the other in Berlin, with a compositional study, seemingly for an entombment at right angles to the main studies. They were followed by a pair of sheets executed in red and black chalk, with elements of white heightening on blue paper. I'm showing you the first one, obviously, in both of which the pose of the mother is studied, initially from a nude male model, as you see. The second also includes the kneeling woman in profile behind her. Her pointing left arm and hand, as well as other details, are studied in a chalk drawing on prepared paper, and the same medium is employed in a sheet of studies, above all, of her torso. So that's the pointing arm, you can see, and that's the torso. To them may be added a double study for the arms of the kneeling boy, again in Dessau, and a pair of studies for the woman in profile at the left edge of the picture. There also exists what appears to be an autograph study for that lady in oil on paper. The grandmotherly figure beyond her, looking heavenwards, does not feature in any of the studies for the altarpiece, but conversely, the left arm of the child in her arms does appear to be explored in yet another sheet in Dessau. Last, but by no means least, comes a whole sequence of studies for the head of the mother, including in the centre here a stunningly beautiful one executed in Barocci's pastel anticipating signature technique of coloured chalks, where, however, her coiffure comes closer to what we see in the Chicago sheet than to the altarpiece. The centre foreground of the composition is filled by the substantial presence of the crippled beggar, for whom there are a number of preliminary studies. As is the case with so many other figures within the composition, his pose is modified between the bent sheet and the altarpiece, not least in response to the changes in the narrative which affect the figures with whom he interacts. The consequence is that it is possible to reconstruct an approximate sequence of execution for these studies, since some are related to the drawing and others to the painting. Predictably enough, the thing that almost all of them have in common is the fact that the beggar is shown stretched out with his feet to the left and his head to the right. There are only two exceptions, and here are all various studies. There are only two exceptions. One is a luminous study in black, red and white chalks on blue paper in the Uffizi, which also includes studies for the hurdy-gurdy player looking up to heaven, as in the Chicago drawing, and down to earth. It explores the idea of showing the beggar from the front, with his head alternately to the left or the right, in one instance apparently being ministered to by another figure. And I hope... Oh, God, I've pressed the wrong button, sorry. Back. You can see him up. I can't see very well from here and down. I think... Sorry. The other drawing with him going the wrong way, so to speak, is a squared sheet in Berlin executed in black chalk and charcoal and blue paper, which shows the naked figure in the opposite direction. Yet another drawing in Berlin is a close-up of the head and upper body of the beggar executed in coloured chalks, in which Barocci is still exploring the man's profile. As I have said, in the bent drawing, the beggar is receiving alms from a member of the confraternity. And this donor is also the subject of a single sheet of studies in the Uffizi, executed in a combination of black and white chalks and charcoal. It is an unusually complex, layered palimpsest of ideas with no fewer than four versions of the upper half of the figure. One in which he is shown full length but appears to be kneeling, perhaps to help the beggar to his feet, and two more detailed considerations of his right hand. The scale of the hand in the larger of the two, which is approximately 10 centimetres high, is perhaps unexpected, given that this whole area, and therefore this particular detail, was ultimately entirely recast. As I've explained, this almsgiver was eventually supplanted by a gypsy woman with a small child in her arms, who are the subjects of various studies, including a spectacular nude study in red chalk, as well as a close-up of her right arm, no surprise where that is, in Dessau. The last of the principal figures who remains to be considered is the blind hurdy-gurdy player. In a sheet in the Uffizi, which we've already seen, he is not only shown looking upwards, as in the bent sheet, but also tellingly in an attitude that precisely anticipates the solution found in the altarpiece. This should serve as an alert, were it still needed, that Barocci may on occasion have explored two solutions for the poses of an individual figure or figures simultaneously. In this specific instance, the consequence is that there is no guarantee that all the detailed studies for the hurdy-gurdy player with lowered head were made after the bent drawing. As it happens, only one other extant drawing for the entire figure is indisputably related to what might be termed the ecstatic attitude of the musician. This is a sheet in Berlin, squared in black chalk and executed in charcoal heightened with white, which represents the figure in the nude with a hurdy-gurdy and then restudies the left arm, both as an écorché, as a flayed figure, and also with an indication of drapery above the elbow and holding the musical instrument. In the top left corner, finally, there is a study of a head looking down and although its attitude is rather different, the closed eyes suggest it must be a first idea for the second redaction of the hurdy-gurdy player. A red chalk drawing in the Uffizi, which is a detailed study of the figure's left leg, must also be connected with the first phase of the design, because the raised heel found here is flattened in the final painting. There are incomparably more drawings for what was to become the definitive solution, including a number which studied the hurdy-gurdy player from a nude life model. One of these nude studies is combined with a detailed study in coloured chalks for his head in a sheet in the Uffizi, which I'll come to, I hope, there, because there are quite a few. Just show you them briefly, but that's the one with the head. Detailed study in coloured chalks for his head in a sheet in the Uffizi. It might not unreasonably be supposed that such a study would have been executed very late on in the evolution of the design. Yet, immediately below the head is a study of the same figure looking up, as in the Chicago drawing, and were this connection to be doubted, then the killer detail is the right hand at top left, where the disposition of every single one of the fingers matches the winding right hand in the bent sheet to perfection and is not the same as what you see in the altarpiece. There. That hand corresponds with that, not with the altarpiece. Unarguably the most impressive of all the drawings for the hurdy-gurdy player is this substantial study for his head in red, black and white chalks. I found it under the name of Cigoli, it is thus inscribed in an old hand, together with a study for the Madonna del Gatto by Barocci in the National Gallery in London. I found them in the old catalogue of the National Museum in Poznan, but a visit to the institution's website revealed that they had beaten me to it and changed the attribution, so I can't claim to be the first person to have worked this out. Nevertheless, to the best of my knowledge, this major addition has eluded the scholarly literature on Barocci, which is a reflection of the way we live today. So you can find it on Google, but you can't find it in the learned tomes on Barocci. To it should be added a number of studies for the hurdy-gurdy player's arms and legs. And this is a very splendid one. That's another one. And then two more of his left arm in Dessau again. The only group of studies which remains to be considered is devoted to the various figures of members of the confraternity who fill the right margin and middle distance of the composition. Of these sheets, I should like to single out this one, a drawing in the Uffizi, which includes seven individual studies. One must relate to the beggar, but most of the remainder seem to be connected with the praying figures in the middle ground. And three, one is of the kneeling figure facing straight ahead and bowing his head in prayer. Another is of his companion holding a candlestick. And a third is of that chap's right hand. They are to all intents and purposes identical to their counterparts in the bent drawing. And that's the hand, and that's the chap with the—that's the man with the candlestick. And yes, there are other beautiful drawings which I'm not going to dwell on. Plenty. Finally, turning to the Madonna del Popolo itself, and above all to its iconography, What is most striking is the way in which Baroche turns out to have chosen to adapt and revitalise an always relatively uncommon, by this date all but moribund, theme known as the double intercession. The ultimate Italian precedent for Baroche's painting is a picture on canvas which used to live in the cloisters but is now in the main building of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It was evidently painted around 1400 and has recently been attributed, in my opinion convincingly, to Lorenzo Monaco. Whether it was originally intended to be an altarpiece remains uncertain. Canvas is unusual. But it undoubtedly soon made its way to an altar on the retro facade of Florence Cathedral and was to prove to be an extremely influential image. As stated above, its theme is the double intercession, and it represents the Virgin presenting her breast to Christ with one hand and extending the other towards a group of kneeling figures between them and on earth, while Christ in turn points out the Virgin, indicates the wound in his side, and appeals to the half-length figure of God the Father up above in a radiance, who looks down at him and directs the dove of the Holy Spirit towards him. The theological basis for the imagery was above all the Speculum Humanae Salvationis, an anonymous text, universally believed at the time to have been written by St. Bernard. The inclusion of the dove of the Holy Spirit has been interpreted as being related to the dedication of the altar, where this picture ended up, but in fact the presence of the three persons of the Trinity in subsequent representations of the subject is all but ubiquitous and is simply one of the elements in this rare iconographic scheme. On the other hand, this should not be taken as implying that the iconography remained ossified. In cataloguing the canvas formerly in the cloisters, Federico Zeri and Elizabeth Gardner were able to build on the initial researches of Millard Meiss and to arrive at a total of no fewer than seven subsequent variations on the theme. A number of them include modifications of various details, some of which were not subsequently emulated, while others directly anticipate Baroche's treatment. Thus, the Master of the Sherman Predella presents God the Father more even-handedly, adds the instruments of the Passion to the scene, and, tellingly, in connection with the Madonna del Popolo, does not show the Virgin's breast uncovered. The same cover-up occurs in a painting of uncertain authorship in Potsdam. I'm showing it to you on the left in black and white. I'm not showing it to you at all, of which I do not have an image. I couldn't get an image of that one, sorry. But it's uncovered again in this one in black and white in Montreal, which is attributed to Gerardo di Giovanni, and where the popolo, where the people, includes children, and the only major addition is of an introductory figure of St. Bernard, whose presence is obviously explained by this connection with the text that was believed to have been written by St. Bernard. In both those pictures, however, God the Father is represented as an old man, and this becomes the norm. The most artistically distinguished double intercession before Baroche is Filippino Lippi's altarpiece now in Munich, which you're seeing on the right, in which the Annunciation has been added to the mix. The popolo has been pushed right back into the middle distance, and the dove of the Holy Spirit is omitted. But for the rest, the iconography is unchanged. And there are the popolo, and they're really very different from most. To these registered, so to speak, descendants of the original prototype may be added two more, which however differ from all but one of the others in not including the popolo. The first is the central element of an altarpiece by Gentile da Fabriano in the church of San Niccolò Oltrano in Florence, whose thematic links with the canvas formerly in Florence Cathedral have been recognized. It differs from its model not only in its resolutely frontal and balanced presentation of God the Father, and in the way the dove is positioned centrally between Christ and the Virgin, but above all in locating them in the celestial as opposed to the terrestrial sphere. The second, and I'm sorry about this image too, but I wanted it in colour, is an altarpiece of 1523 by Giacone in Santa Lucia de' Magnoli in Florence, whose true subject matter was apparently not grasped by Vasari and has remained pretty much misunderstood ever since, but which reverts to the original mode of representation. Turning to the Madonna del Popolo, the first point to make is that it was a minor stroke of genius on Barocci's part to position the figure of God the Father in a tondo in the pediment, which he anyway had to fill, since it allowed him to present him both apart from the main action, in a kind of glory, and at half length, thus avoiding anachronistic artifice while at the same time adhering to tradition. Similarly, both the direction of God's gaze down towards Christ and the blessing gesture of his right hand are canonical. Proceeding further down, the presentation of Christ and the Virgin, and indeed the dove, is less rigorously based on earlier treatments of the theme. Christ is fully clothed and does not really intercede on behalf of the popolo, but instead directly blesses them, while the Virgin flings both her arms wide in supplication and fails even to gesture towards her breast. And the dove is between and below them rather than above and closer to Christ. The major difference, however, concerns the treatment of the popolo. In previous double intercessions, as we've seen, they had been shown as a static and largely faceless group, whereas here Barocci has both personalized them and brought them to life to such an extent that in his 1672 Vitae, which includes the first major biography of Barocci, Gian Pietro Bellori could exaggeratedly claim that the seven acts of mercy were represented. Such an iconography would have neatly reasserted the theme of misericordia. But while it is possible to identify figures in the background feeding prisoners and the more prominent giving of alms, that is as far as it goes. If in doubt, feel free to follow my example and try and find the burying of the dead. I've looked pretty hard and it's not there. It is important to add that, as has rightly been observed, the Madonna del Popolo was not unprecedented in its ambition to animate God's people. However, arguably the most successful as well as ambitious such enterprise prior to Barocci was precisely a Madonna della Misericordia. This was Fra Bartolomeo's altarpiece of 1515 on the theme for the Dominican Church of San Romano at Lucca, now in the Museo di Villa Guinigi in that town. It is immaterial whether Barocci was acquainted with it, which seems unlikely, given his reluctance to travel, or not. Even if he did know it, he clearly did not plunder it for ideas, but its cast of around 40 characters in a whole variety of poses and actions showed how the plenitude of monumental mural painting could be adapted in an altarpiece. Naturally, Barocci went much further and created one of the most controlled but at the same time endlessly rich altarpieces of the entire 16th century. It is tempting to stress the way it seems to anticipate all sorts of aspects of the Baroque altarpiece, but it is arguably better to admire it in its own right, above all for its triumphant holding of the balance between the heavenly and the earthly, and for its combination of energy and variety of the local and the universal. The Madonna del Popolo is probably Barocci's masterpiece and was unquestionably destined to remain unsurpassed within his oeuvre. the vast and extraordinary corpus of extant drawings connected with it, and above all, as I'm showing you, the ex Chatsworth sheet, now in Anne Bent's collection, for all that that huge body of drawings must represent only the tip of the iceberg, they bear eloquent witness to how hard he worked to achieve an effect of almost miraculous immediacy. Thank you very much.